Before we really jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you're prepping for the Series 65, I mean, you know they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. So check them out at certfuel.com.
Definitely worth a look.
Yeah, totally. Anyway, let's get right into it. Imagine you start like just a simple lemonade stand on your street corner,
Okay,
right?
classic.
Yeah. A customer buys a glass, takes this massive gulp, and chips their tooth on a jagged piece of ice. Next thing you know, they sue you for $10,000 in dental bills.
Oh, wow. That's a bad day.
Right. And you think, well, the business will just go bankrupt, but my personal savings, you know, they're safe. Then you wake up to find the bank foreclosing on your actual personal home to pay the settlement.
Which is terrifying, honestly.
It's a nightmare. So today, we're exploring these invisible legal barriers that either protect your life savings from your business mistakes or, well, leave you completely exposed.
And we are tackling a very specific mission today for you, the listener. We're going to conquer the client type section of the Series 65 exam.
The whole
The
thing?
whole thing. Now, to put this in perspective, this material accounts for about 3% of the exam.
Which is what, like three questions?
Exactly. Roughly three questions. And I know three questions might sound kind of trivial in the grand
Yeah,
scheme.
people might want to skip it.
Right. But on a pass-fail licensing exam, I mean, three questions is frequently the exact margin between celebrating at a fancy steakhouse and sitting in your car just dreading having to pay that rescheduling fee.
Yeah, we do not want to be paying that fee. Every single point is a prisoner of war, and we are bringing them all home today.
For sure.
But I want to, break the fourth wall and talk directly to you, the listener, for a second. We know that reading about tax codes and legal entity structures, trusts, it can feel like watching paint dry in a windowless room.
It really can. It's incredibly dry material.
So dry. So if your brain tends to wander, if those standard monotone lectures lose you immediately, do not worry. We are taking that format and basically throwing it straight into a wood chipper today.
I love that.
Yeah, we've set some strict ground rules for this deep dive to keep you entirely locked in.
Yeah, so first rule, there will be no dry textbook reading, none. We're focusing heavily on the mechanics, like the actual why and the how behind these rules.
Because memorizing lists is impossible.
It's impossible and it's useless. Once you understand the underlying logic of, say, why the IRS or the SEC created a specific rule, you don't have to memorize a random list of facts. You can just sort of deduce the answer based on how the system is engineered.
Right, you just reverse engineer it in your head. And we're also going to rely on some truly absurd, vivid analogies.
Which always helps.
Always. I'm actually going to ask you, the listener, direct questions throughout this discussion. So be prepared to pause whatever you're doing, whether you're driving or walking the dog, and actually think of the answer before we give it to you.
Active recall is huge. And to make this feel like an actual story rather than an audio dictionary, we're going to use a recurring cast of hypothetical characters.
Yes, I love our characters.
Because attaching an abstract legal concept to a specific personality, it just makes it infinitely easier to recall under the stress of an exam.
Totally.
So let me introduce you to the two people you'll be spending this deep dive with. First, we have Frantic Frank.
Good old Frank.
Frank is this guy who is always starting new businesses. He has endless chaotic energy. He absolutely despises paying taxes, and he is perpetually terrified of being sued.
I feel like we all know a frantic Frank. He's that guy who buys a new domain name at like 2 a.m. every Tuesday because he's convinced he's found the next billion-dollar tech unicorn.
That is Frank, exactly. And our second character is generous Gina. Gina is Frank's incredibly wealthy aunt.
That could be nice.
Right. She has a massive net worth. She's highly philanthropic, and she loves setting up trusts and donating her money.
But there's a catch with Gina, right?
There is a massive catch. Her defining psychological trait is this generous Gina absolutely hates losing control.
Ah, okay.
She wants to give her wealth away, sure, but she wants to pull all the strings from behind the curtain.
So we've got Frantic Frank, the founder, and Generous Gina, the wealthy, controlling aunt. But before Frank can build this massive multinational corporate empire, he has to start at the very beginning.
Right at the bottom.
Exactly. He has to start as just a regular person walking down the street. And the exam groups these foundational concepts together, forming the absolute baseline for everything else we're going to discuss today.
Yeah, we really need to dissect the difference between a natural person and an individual.
Which, to a normal human being, those sound like literal synonyms.
In casual conversation, they completely are synonyms. But In the hyper-specific legal and financial world of the Series 65, they're distinctly different concepts.
So break that down for us. What's a natural person?
A natural person is simply a biological fact. It means a living, breathing human being. You, me, Frank, Gina.
We have a pulse.
We are not robots. We're not artificial intelligence. We aren't corporate entities. And we're not legal trusts. We are natural persons.
So if a natural person is just the biological entity, the flesh and blood, what makes them an individual in the eyes of the exam?
It's all about capacity.
Okay, I like to think of a natural person as the actor, right? And the individual as the specific role they are playing on stage.
That's a great way to look at it. An individual is a natural person acting in their own personal capacity as a client.
Right.
So when Frantic Frank walks into an advisory firm and opens a brokerage account just for himself, using his own savings to buy and sell stocks for his own retirement, he is an individual client.
That distinction is paramount, right? Because
yeah.
If Frank walks into your office representing his corporation, the corporation is the client, not Frank as an individual.
Exactly. And when you're dealing with an individual client, the regulatory scrutiny on how you advise them is intense.
You can't just take his money and gamble it.
No, absolutely not. You cannot simply take Frank's money and throw it into a highly leveraged speculative hedge fund without doing some serious detective work first.
You have to build a profile. Let's look at the suitability factors you're legally required to assess when an individual client sits across your desk.
Right. You're looking at their life stage first and foremost.
Right. Like, is Frank 25 years old, single, with no dependents, and 40 years until retirement? Or is Frank 65, hoping to retire in 8 months, with two kids in college?
That life stage completely dictates the time horizon. Because a 25-year-old can weather a massive stock market crash.
Yeah, they have decades for the market to recover.
Exactly. But a 65-year-old, they might be financially ruined by that exact same crash.
So age and stage are huge. What else?
You also have to look at income stability and family obligations. Does Frank have a steady salary? Or does his income fluctuate wildly because he's constantly starting random businesses?
Which, knowing Frank, it fluctuates wildly. And we can't forget taxes. The tax bracket is a massive suitability factor. If Frank somehow strikes gold and finds himself in the absolute highest federal tax bracket, you as the advisor might recommend municipal bonds. Why? Because the interest generated by municipal bonds is generally exempt from federal income taxes.
Right. It acts as a legal shelter for his income.
But if Frank is barely scraping by, sitting in a very low tax bracket, putting him in municipal bonds is terrible advice.
It's honestly bordering on malpractice.
Mm.
Because municipal bonds inherently offer a lower yield than corporate bonds, precisely because of that tax advantage.
So if he doesn't need the shelter, he's just losing money.
Exactly. If Frank doesn't need the tax shelter, you're just sacrificing his yield for a benefit he can't even legally use.
Yeah.
And alongside taxes, you must assess liquidity needs.
Liquidity, which is basically how fast you can turn an investment into usable cash without taking a huge loss.
Correct.
Like if Frank tells you, hey, I need $50,000 in 6 months to buy a house, you can't lock his money up in a 10-year annuity with massive surrender charges.
Or a private real estate partnership that he can't sell.
Exactly. For short-term capital needs, liquidity is king.
Okay, so we've established Frank as an individual client. We know his risk profile. You know, Frank is frantic. He's tired of just investing his savings. He wants to build a business.
There you go.
Right. He decides he's going to open that lemonade stand we talked about. And because he's impulsive, he doesn't consult a lawyer.
Of course not.
He doesn't file any articles of organization with the state government. He doesn't pay any filing fees. He literally goes to the grocery store, buys a bag of lemons, sets up a folding table on the public sidewalk, and starts selling cups of lemonade for a dollar.
And just by doing that, boom, he's a business.
Yes. By doing this simple act of conducting business, he has just created a sole proprietorship.
It is the absolute easiest, simplest, and cheapest business structure in existence.
Requires zero effort to form. You just start doing business.
And from a pure tax perspective, it's incredibly straightforward, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. All the income from that folding table passes directly through to Frank's personal tax return.
Using what form?
The IRS uses a specific form for this, called a Schedule C. There is no separate tax return for the lemonade stand itself. The business doesn't pay taxes. Frank pays taxes on whatever the business earns.
Which is called pass-through taxation. That sounds like a wonderful benefit. But here is where we encounter one of the most common pitfalls for test takers.
Yes, the exam writers love this area.
Because they know that sole proprietorships sound great on paper, they're so simple. So they will try to blur the lines between the natural person, the individual, and the business entity itself when it comes to liability.
This is exactly what you were talking about in the intro.
Yes. Okay, listener, I'm going to ask you a direct question. I want you to really think about the legal barriers here. Imagine Frantic Frank's lemonade stand gets sued. That customer buys the lemonade, chips their tooth on the ice, and sues for $10,000.
Ouch.
Does Frank have any liability protection because it was technically the quote-unquote business that caused the injury and not him personally? Give you a second to lock in your answer. Think about it.
Take a guess.
The answer is absolutely categorically no. He has zero protection.
None at all. And to understand why, you have to understand the legal fiction, or rather the total lack of a legal fiction here.
Right. There's no wall.
None. In a sole proprietorship, there is no legal separation between the owner and the business.
No.
They're identical. Frank IS, the lemonade stand, and the lemonade stand IS Frank.
So when they sue the stand, they're just suing Frank.
Exactly. When the customer sues the lemonade stand, they're directly suing Frank's biological and financial personhood.
This is what lawyers call unlimited personal liability, and it is terrifying. I mean, if the business owes 10 grand for that chipped tooth, and Frank's little cigar box cash register only has 20 bucks in it, the creditors don't just say, oh, well, and walk away empty-handed.
Well, they definitely do not.
They are legally permitted to come after Frank's personal assets. They can force him to sell his personal car.
Yep.
They can garnish his personal bank accounts. They can even put a lien on his house, all to pay for a mistake made at a folding table on the sidewalk.
It's the ultimate financial risk.
Yeah.
And there's another major structural downside to a sole proprietorship that you must sear into your memory for the exam to build. There is no continuity of life.
Okay, continuity of life. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means the business entity only exists as long as the biological owner is alive.
Okay.
So if Frantic Frank tragically chokes on one of his own lemons and dies on Tuesday, the sole proprietorship instantly ceases to exist on Tuesday.
So you can't leave it to your kids.
You cannot pass a sole proprietorship down to your children. I mean, the physical assets, the lemons, the folding table, the cash fan, those might pass down through his will. But the legal structure of the business, it dies the exact millisecond the owner dies.
Okay, so pass-through taxation is the pro. Unlimited personal liability and lack of continuity are the massive cons.
Exactly.
And Frank, he realizes this. He looks at his folding table and realizes that selling beverages with zero legal shield is just reckless. Plus, he wants to buy a massive commercial-grade ice machine so he stops chipping people's teeth.
Smart move.
But a commercial ice machine costs $10,000, and Frank is broke. So he needs capital.
And where does Frank go when he needs capital? He goes to generous Gina.
He goes to his extraordinarily wealthy aunt. He pitches her the lemonade stand expansion, and she agrees to invest. They decide to team up. So we're now leaving the solo operator behind and moving into the realm of partnerships.
Specifically, the battle between general partnerships and limited partnerships.
Let's start with the general partnership, which you'll often see abbreviated as a GP on the test.
Right. The legal definition is pretty straightforward. Two or more persons carrying on a business as co-owners for profit.
Okay, pretty simple.
And just like the sole proprietorship we just discussed, the general partnership utilizes pass-through taxation.
So no corporate tax.
Right. The partnership entity itself doesn't pay an income tax. Instead, the profits or the losses flow straight through to Frank and Gina's personal tax returns, divided by whatever percentage they agreed to in their partnership agreement.
Pass-through taxation remains a great benefit, but I see a massive red flag here. What happens to the management authority and the liability when you bring a second person into a general partnership?
It becomes incredibly dangerous.
Why?
Because in a default general partnership, every single partner has equal management authority and unlimited personal liability.
Whoa, equal authority.
Yes, unless they draft a highly specific, complex legal agreement saying otherwise. Default state partnership law says Frank has full authority to sign contracts, take out loans, and bind the business.
And Gina has that exact same authority too.
Exactly.
I need to push back on this to make sure we are crystal clear on how the exam tests this. Let's invent a disaster.
Okay, lay it on me.
Frank makes a catastrophic unilateral business decision. He finds a sketchy supplier selling incredibly cheap, glowing green lemons. It turns out they're highly radioactive.
Obviously.
Obviously. 10 customers get radiation sickness, and the lemonade stand gets slapped with a multi-million dollar class action lawsuit. Now, Frank bought those lemons without telling Gina. He didn't text her. He didn't call her. Is generous Gina personally on the hook for that multi-million-dollar lawsuit?
Yes, without a shadow of a doubt.
Even though she had absolutely no idea he was buying radioactive fruit.
It does not matter to the outside world. Inside the partnership, sure, Frank and Gina have a fiduciary duty to each other, a duty of loyalty, and a duty of care.
So she could sue him?
Gina could potentially sue Frank later for breaching that duty by buying dangerous supplies. But to the outside world, to the victims and their lawyers, those creditors can come after both Frank and Gina's personal assets.
Joint and several liability, right?
Exactly. Joint and several liability. And since Gina is the wealthy aunt with the mansion and the massive portfolio, the plaintiff's lawyers are going to completely ignore broke Frank and go directly after Gina's wealth to pay that settlement.
That is a total nightmare for anyone with a high net worth. General partnerships are basically financial suicide if you have significant personal assets to protect.
They really are. And generous Gina is way too intelligent and experienced to agree to a general partnership. She looks at Frank, remembers his history of terrible impulsive decisions, and says, "I will write the check for the ice machine, but I demand we structure this as a limited partnership."
The LP. This is where the legal architecture gets really fascinating, and it is a massive area for exam questions because of all the nuances.
A limited partnership, or LP, is a fundamentally different beast. By law, it requires at least two distinct roles. It must have at least one general partner and at least one limited partner.
Let's assign our cast to these roles. Frank is desperate to run the business, so he takes the role of the general partner. Gina is just supplying the money, so she takes the role of the limited partner.
Right.
Walk me through what this actually means for Frank's day-to-day life.
Well, for Frank, as the general partner, his life looks exactly like it did in the GP. He retains full management authority.
He's still the boss?
Yep. He runs the day-to-day operations. He hires the employees. He buys the lemons. But because he demands the power to manage the business, the law forces him to accept the risk.
So he still carries unlimited personal liability?
Yes. If the LP gets sued, Frank still goes down with the ship.
He has the power, so he holds the risk. But what about Gina? What's her reality as the limited partner?
Gina's reality is much, much safer. She provides the capital. She writes the $10,000 check for the ice machine. Because she's a limited partner, she is granted limited liability.
Okay, what does that practically mean for her mansion?
It means the absolute maximum amount of money she can lose in a worst-case scenario is the money she already put into the business.
Just the 10 grand.
Just the 10 grand. If they get sued for $1 million over those radioactive lemons, her personal mansion is entirely safe. Her outside brokerage accounts are entirely safe.
That sounds like a cheat code for rich people. I mean, she gets to share in the profits of the lemonade stand, but she's completely insulated from the catastrophic risks. There has to be a trade-off.
There is. The legal system doesn't just hand out bulletproof shields for free.
Right. So what does she give up?
To maintain that limited liability shield, Gina must completely surrender all management authority.
All of it.
All of it. She cannot make business decisions. She cannot hire or fire employees. She cannot negotiate with suppliers. She must remain a completely passive investor.
I love the symmetry of that logic. If you want the power to drive the car, you have to accept the risk of paying for the crash. If you want to be protected from the financial ruin of a crash, you have to sit quietly in the back seat and let someone else drive.
You cannot have it both ways.
Precisely. Now let's talk about the worst case scenario. Let's say the radioactive lemon lawsuit bankrupts the business. The lemonade stand fails and has to be liquidated.
The exam loves testing the liquidation priority of a limited partnership.
Let's get into it. When a business is dismantled and its assets are sold off for cash, there is a strict legal hierarchy of who gets paid back first. Let's think through the logic.
Right.
The creditors have to get paid right. The business owes money to the bank that gave them a small business loan, the company that sold them the ice machine. They're at the front of the line.
Always. Secured creditors first, then unsecured.
Right. But after the creditors are fully satisfied, if there is a tiny bit of cash left over, who is next? Does Frank get his cut or does Gina?
Gina is next. The limited partners get paid out before the general partners.
Ah, okay.
So Gina gets her capital returned to her before Frank sees a single dime. The general partner, Frank, is at the absolute bottom of the priority list. He's a captain going down with the ship.
Which means he gets whatever is left over at the very end, which in a bankruptcy is usually zero.
Exactly.
Now, here's a scenario where I see people fail the exam all the time. The test writers will set up a hypothetical that sounds completely innocent, but it contains a fatal flaw.
Let's do it.
I have a direct question for you, listener. Imagine this scenario. Generous Gina is driving her luxury car past the lemonade stand one busy Saturday afternoon. She sees a massive line of angry, sweating customers.
Not a good look.
She notices the teenage employees Frank hired are just standing around looking confused and completely overwhelmed. Gina gets furious. It's her money on the line, after all.
Yep.
She parks her car, marches into the stand, grabs an apron, and starts barking orders. You start cutting lemons. You take the cash. Move faster.
Which is a very relatable scenario. Anyone who has invested money in a struggling project wants to step in and fix it.
We all want to fix it. So, listener, based on what we just discussed about the trade-off for liability protection, what just happened to Gina's bulletproof shield? Think about her actions for a second.
Take a guess what the courts would say.
She just blew it up into a million pieces.
She destroyed it completely. The rule is incredibly strict, and the courts do not mess around with it.
Not at all.
If a limited partner participates in the day-to-day management of the business, they forfeit their limited liability protection.
Just by handing out aprons and barking orders.
Just by that. The courts will look at Gina's actions, see that she was acting like a manager by directing employees, and rule, well, congratulations, Gina, you wanted to manage. You are now legally treated as a general partner.
Wow. Which means her personal mansion and her outside bank accounts are suddenly back on the table for creditors to attack.
Yep. The lesson for the exam is absolute deserves. Limited partners must stay completely passive or they lose the shield. You cannot dabble in management.
Okay, so Frank and Gina have their LP. But let's look at Frank's situation. He's tired. He's tired of carrying all the personal risk. He looks at Gina's liability shield with intense jealousy.
Naturally.
He wants liability protection for himself, too. He wants to actively manage the business. He wants to make the decisions. But he does not want his personal car taken away if someone sues the lemonade stand.
He wants to have his cake and eat it, too.
Exactly. And for a long time in business history, that just wasn't possible. You were either a risky partnership or a double-taxed corporation.
But modern law evolved to give Frank exactly what he wants. We're now moving into the protective shells.
The legal barriers.
Yes. The entities that provide a legally recognized barrier between the business's debts and the owner's personal assets. We're going to explore LLCs, S corporations, and C corporations.
Let's start with the limited liability company, the LLC. I like to think of the LLC as the ultimate hybrid vehicle.
It really is.
It's as if corporate lawyers took the best parts of a partnership and the best parts of a corporation, threw them in a blender, and created the perfect entity.
That's exactly what it was designed to be.
Yeah.
An LLC gives Frank the pass-through taxation of a partnership, meaning no double taxation, all profits and losses flow right to his personal tax return.
Mm-hmm.
But it simultaneously gives him the limited liability protection of a corporation.
And here is the crucial mechanical difference between an LLC and the limited partnership we just talked about. In an LLC, Frank can be an active, aggressive manager.
Right.
He can run the day-to-day operations. He can fire people. He can negotiate massive contracts. And he still gets to keep his limited liability shield.
In an LLC, all owners, who are called members, by the way, enjoy limited liability, regardless of how active or passive they are.
So it completely removes that dangerous trap that caught Gina.
Completely. And LLCs are incredibly flexible. Unlike a traditional corporation that is governed by a rigid state-mandated charter with formal bylaws, an LLC is governed by an internal operating agreement.
Okay, I think of the operating agreement like the genetic DNA of the company.
How so?
Well, in a corporation, the skeleton is rigid. If you own 10% of the stock, you get 10% of the profits. But with an LLC's operating agreement, you can genetically engineer the profit splits however you want.
Oh, absolutely.
Frank and Gina could agree that Frank gets 80% of the profits, even though Gina put in 100% of the money. The LLC allows for that unequal distribution if it's written in their DNA, their operating agreement.
That flexibility is exactly why LLCs are the most popular entity choice for small to medium businesses today. Furthermore, there is absolutely no limit on the number of members an LLC can have.
None at all.
None. You can have one member or you can have 1,000. And those members can be natural persons, other corporations, or even foreign entities located in other countries.
Okay, so the LLC sounds like the perfect, flawless business structure. Pass-through taxes, liability protection, total flexibility. Why would anyone ever choose anything else?
Well, before the LLC became widely adopted in the late 20th century, businesses use an older structure to get these same benefits. That brings us to the S-corporation.
Ah, the S-corp.
An S-corporation is very similar to an LLC in its ultimate benefits. It also provides a limited liability shield for its owners, and it also utilizes pass-through taxation.
So it avoids the dreaded double taxation by making a special election under subchapter S of the Internal Revenue Code.
Correct.
But if they both provide limited liability and pass-through taxation, how on earth does the exam test the difference between an LLC and an S-corp?
The exam will test you mercilessly on the restrictions. This is critical exam fodder.
Okay, wait a minute.
The IRS is essentially saying, we will grant you this highly favorable subchapter S tax treatment, but in exchange, we demand you adhere to a very strict, very narrow set of rules. You need to understand the mechanics of these restrictions.
Let's go through them. Rule number one, an S-corp can have a maximum of 100 shareholders. Not 101. 100 is the absolute cap.
Exactly. Rule number two, all shareholders must be U.S. citizens or resident aliens. Absolutely no foreign owners are allowed.
So if Frank decides to sell a single share of his S-corp to his cousin who lives in London and is not a U.S. resident, what happens?
The S-corp status is instantly destroyed. The IRS revokes it, and the company reverts to a heavily taxed C-corporation.
Wow, that's brittle. Okay, rule number three, you are only allowed to have one class of stock.
Right. You can issue voting shares and non-voting shares, but they all have to be common stock with equal economic rights.
So you cannot issue common stock to Frank and special preferred stock with guaranteed dividends to Gina. One class only.
And rule number four, the owners must be natural persons, individuals, or certain specific types of trusts or estates. You cannot have another corporation or a partnership own shares in an S-corp.
I was looking at these S-corp restrictions, and they seem incredibly xenophobic and arbitrary. I mean, no foreign owners, only 100 people. Why on earth does the IRS care if my British cousin owns a share or if I have 105 shareholders instead of 100?
It's all about the mechanics of tax collection.
How so?
Remember, an S-corp uses pass-through taxation. The corporation itself doesn't pay taxes. The IRS relies on the individual shareholders to report the income and pay the tax on their personal returns.
Right.
Imagine if an S-corp had 10,000 shareholders scattered across 50 different countries. The IRS would have to track down a guy in London, a woman in Tokyo, and a partnership in Brazil just to collect the tax on the lemonade stand's profits.
Oh, that would be an administrative nightmare.
Huge nightmare. By restricting it to 100 domestic individuals, the IRS ensures they can easily audit the owners and collect their money.
That makes total sense. They're just minimizing their own paperwork.
Exactly.
Okay, so Frank's lemonade stand becomes a national sensation. He wants to raise $50 million to build a massive automated lemonade factory. He wants to bring in institutional investors from Japan and Europe. He wants to issue preferred stock to venture capitalists who demand priority payouts.
He cannot use an S-corp because he immediately violates almost every restriction we just listed.
He's got too many shareholders, foreign investors, multiple classes of stock.
Right. He has to enter the big leagues. He has to restructure as a C corporation.
The C corporation.
Yeah.
The heavyweight champion of the corporate world.
The C corporation is a completely separate legal entity from its owners. It's like a standalone, immortal legal person. It has perpetual existence. It does not die when Frank dies.
Unlike the sole proprietorship.
Right. It can have millions of shareholders of any type from anywhere in the world. It is managed by a formal board of directors rather than directly by the owners and can issue as many different classes of stock as it wants.
It sounds incredibly powerful. You can raise billions of dollars. But there's always a catch. What is the massive downside to a C corp?
Double taxation.
Let me expand on an analogy for double taxation because visualizing the mechanics of this is vital for the exam.
Go for it.
Imagine a C-corp is like a highly exclusive, very expensive nightclub. The physical nightclub itself is the corporation. Now, the business generates $1 million in profit. But before that profit can actually get inside the club to be enjoyed, the IRS bouncer is standing at the front door.
Waiting for his cut.
Exactly. The IRS charges a massive cover charge just to let the profits in the building. That cover charge is the corporate income tax.
Right. So the corporation files its own tax return and pays tax on its net income at the corporate rate.
The cover charge and paid. Now the money is inside the club. The shareholder, the owners who actually provided the capital, want to take some of that profit home. They want to order a drink.
Yep.
When the corporation distributes those profits to the shareholders in the form of a cash dividend, the IRS bouncer walks up to their table and taxes that exact same money a second time on the shareholder's personal tax return.
Brutal.
So you paid $50 at the door, and now you're paying $20 for a drink using the money that already got taxed. That is double taxation.
Right.
The exact same dollar of profit gets hit twice.
It is wildly inefficient from a tax perspective when you compare it to the single layer of pass-through taxation in an LLC or S-Corp.
So the logical question is, why would anyone willingly choose a C-Corp?
Because they want to go public.
Ah, okay.
Exactly, because it is the only legal structure that allows you to have unlimited investors, institutional investors, foreign investors, and the ability to easily issue different classes of stock to raise massive amounts of capital.
So if you want your lemonade company's ticker symbol scrolling across the bottom of the screen on CNBC.
Right. If you want to trade on the New York Stock Exchange, you're going to be a C corporation and you're going to accept double taxation as just the cost of doing business.
Okay, let's break the pattern here. I want to do a side-by-side comparison, rapid fire. The test writers are going to put these entities in a blender and try to confuse you by mixing and matching their traits.
They absolutely will.
I'm going to ask the question, and I want you, the listener, to try to answer it out loud before the expert does. Let's see how well you've absorbed this.
Let's test it.
Question one. Which business entities provide both limited liability protection and pass-through taxation? I'll give you a second.
The answers are the LLC and the S corporation.
Correct. Now, if you said general partnership, you fell for a trap. GPs have pass-through taxation, but absolutely zero liability protection.
Right, and if you said C-Corp, you fell for another trap. C-Corp have liability protection, but suffer from double taxation.
Only the LLC and S-Corp give you the best of both worlds. Okay, question two. Which entity type has a strict 100 shareholder limit?
The S-Corporation only. No other entity we've discussed today has a legal numerical cap on the number of owners.
Question three, which entity is subject to double taxation?
The C Corporation only. Every other entity in this unit uses some form of single layer pass-through taxation.
Boom. If you can keep those distinct, you have those points in the bag.
For sure.
Let's transition our story a bit. Frantic Frank eventually turns his LLC into a massive, highly lucrative success. Generous Gina is incredibly proud of him.
She made an absolute fortune as an early investor too.
Totally. But time is passing. Gina's getting older. She has accumulated a massive complex estate, and she wants to ensure her wealth is protected, managed properly, and passed down smoothly to her favorite charities and her other nieces and nephews without the government taking half of it.
Which is a perfect pivot into trusts and estates. Now, this is a very heavy, mechanics-driven section of the exam, so let's establish the fundamental architecture first.
Let out.
A trust is not just a piece of paper, a document. It's a legal arrangement. It acts as a separate legal entity. And every single trust has a specific cast of three characters.
Let's cast our play. The first character is the grantor.
Right. And depending on the state, this person is also sometimes called the settlor, the trustor, or the maker.
So many names for the same thing. The grantor is the person with the money who originally creates the trust and funds it. In our ongoing story, this is Generous Gina.
The second character is the trustee. This is the manager. The grantor hands the assets over to the trustee. The trustee holds legal title to the assets and is entirely responsible for managing them.
But they can't just do whatever they want, right?
No, absolutely not. The trustee is bound by a strict fiduciary duty under the Uniform Prudent Investor Act, or UPIA.
We'll drill deep into the UPIA in a future deep dive, but for now, just understand the mechanics. It means the trustee cannot take Gina's millions, fly to Vegas, and put it all on black at the roulette table.
Obviously not.
They can't buy highly speculative meme stocks just for fun. They have to invest prudently, diversifying the portfolio according to modern portfolio theory.
Exactly. And the third character is the beneficiary. This is the person or the organization who holds the quote-unquote equitable title. They're the ones who ultimately get the money or the income generated by the trust.
Okay, here is a concept the exam loves to test, and it trips up experienced advisors all the time.
Oh, this is a big one.
When you, the investment advisor, are hired to manage the money inside a trust, who is your actual client? Who do you report to? Is your client the grantor who funded it? Is it the beneficiary who is constantly begging you for more income?
No. Your client is the trust itself.
The entity.
Yes. The trust is a distinct, separate, legal entity. you must make investment decisions that align perfectly with the specific terms written in the trust document.
So if the beneficiary comes to you and begs you to invest in a high-risk crypto venture because they want a huge payout, but the trust document explicitly says invest for conservative income only,
you must reject the beneficiary's demands. You follow the document. The document is the Constitution.
That is a critical boundary to maintain. Okay, so Gina goes to her estate planning attorney. The attorney sits her down and says, Gina, we have two main buckets of trusts for you to choose from while you're still alive. We have revocable trusts and we have irrevocable trusts.
Let's open the first bucket, the revocable trust, which is commonly called a living trust.
The name kind of gives away the mechanics, doesn't it?
It does. A revocable trust means Gina retains the power to change her mind at any time. She can modify the terms, she can swap out the beneficiaries, or she can completely revoke the entire trust and take all her money back.
So because she retains total unfettered control, she is typically the trustee during her own lifetime, and she is also the primary beneficiary.
Right.
But wait, if she is the grantor, the trustee, and the beneficiary, what is the point? If she's just holding her own money and can take it back whenever she wants, why go through the hassle of paying a lawyer to draft a revocable trust?
The massive overriding benefit of a revocable living trust is that it avoids probate.
Oh, we need to explain probate, because if you haven't dealt with it personally, you might not realize how awful it is.
It's terrible.
Probate is the legal court process of validating a dead person's will and distributing their assets. It is a very public process, meaning anyone can go to the courthouse and see exactly what Gina owned and who she gave it to.
And it is incredibly slow. It can often take a year or more. And it's expensive. The lawyers and the court take a percentage of the estate.
Right. So if Gina puts her assets into a revocable living trust, when she dies, those assets bypass the probate court system entirely.
Exactly. The successor trustee simply steps in and distributes the money to the heirs privately, seamlessly, and instantly.
Bypassing probate sounds amazing. It saves time, money, and privacy. But, and here's a trap that test writers love to lay out. Listen closely to this.
Pay attention here.
We established that a revocable trust avoids probate. But does it remove the assets from Gina's taxable estate? Meaning, does it save her from paying massive estate taxes to the federal government when she dies?
Absolutely not. And that is a fundamental misunderstanding many clients have, which the exam will exploit.
Why doesn't it save on estate taxes?
Because the IRS looks at the mechanics of control. The IRS looks at Gina and says, well, Gina, you can revoke this trust whenever you want. You have total control over the money. You can take it out and buy a yacht tomorrow.
So it's basically still in her pocket.
Right. Therefore, for tax purposes, we consider that money to still be entirely yours. Because she never truly surrendered control, the assets remain in her taxable estate when she dies, and her heirs will have to pay estate taxes on them.
So if Gina is extraordinarily wealthy, and her primary goal isn't just avoiding probate, but actually minimizing the crushing blow of estate taxes, what's her alternative?
She has to use the second bucket. An irrevocable trust.
The word irrevocable just sounds so permanent. It sounds like throwing a suitcase full of cash into a volcano.
Functionally, it is. When Gina transfers her millions into an irrevocable trust, she cannot change her mind. She cannot amend the document. She cannot revoke it. She permanently and legally surrenders control of the assets forever.
By voluntarily giving up that control, what is she actually buying herself? What's the benefit?
She buys two massive legal advantages. First, because she no longer controls the money, the IRS agrees to remove those assets from her taxable estate.
Oh, wow.
So if the trust grows to $50 million over the next 20 years, that growth happens outside of her estate, saving a fortune in estate taxes.
And the second advantage.
Second, because the money is no longer legally hers, it generally provides ironclad asset protection from her personal creditors. If Gina gets sued personally, the creditors cannot touch the money in the irrevocable trust because it simply isn't hers anymore.
Wait, let's look closer at that. I see a potential loophole that sounds a little too good to be true.
There are no loopholes with the IRS.
Well, let's test it. If Gina uses an irrevocable trust and the assets are legally removed from her estate, does the income generated by those assets just magically go untaxed?
Huh?
Like, if the trust earns $1 million in dividends, does no one pay income tax on that? Because that sounds like a billionaire cheat code.
No, do not fall for that trap. Removing assets from an estate for estate tax purposes does not mean no one pays income tax on the profits.
Okay, so who pays?
The irrevocable trust is recognized by the IRS as a completely separate, standalone taxpayer. It has its own tax ID number, and it files its own complex tax return, which is called a Form 1041.
So who actually writes the check to the IRS for the income tax on those dividends?
It depends entirely on the mechanics of what the trust does with the cash.
Walk me through it.
If the trust distributes the income out to the beneficiary, let's say it writes a check to Frank, then the trust gets a deduction, and Frank claims that income on his personal tax return. He pays the tax at his individual bracket.
Okay, that makes sense. But what if it stays in the trust?
And here is the crucial exam concept. If the trust retains the income, meaning it keeps the dividends inside the trust account to reinvest them, the trust itself must pay the income tax.
I've always heard the tax brackets for trusts are absolutely brutal. Let's do the math on this to show why it matters.
The math is punishing. Trusts are subject to what we call highly compressed tax brackets.
Give us a comparative example.
Well, a single individual taxpayer might not hit the absolute highest top marginal income tax rate until they are making over $600,000 a year in income. They have a long runway of lower tax brackets before they hit the ceiling.
Okay, $600,000 for an individual. When does a trust hit that exact same top marginal tax rate?
A trust hits the absolute top marginal tax rate at roughly $15,000 of retained income.
$15,000. It rockets to the maximum penalty immediately.
Immediately, exactly. So if the exam asks you about the tax efficiency of a trust retaining income versus distributing it to an individual, the trust is at a severe disadvantage.
Yeah, obviously.
It pays a much higher effective tax rate because of those aggressively compressed brackets.
What's the logic there?
The underlying logic here is that the IRS does not want wealthy families using trusts as infinite tax-sheltered hoarding vehicles. The tax code is intentionally designed to financially punish trusts that hoard income, thereby incentivizing the trustee to distribute the money out into the real economy.
That makes perfect mechanical sense. The IRS wants the money moving.
Always.
Okay, we've covered living trusts. Let's briefly touch on the final type of trust you might see, which is a testamentary trust.
Testamentary. The root word there is testament, as in a last will and testament.
Right. So a testamentary trust is not created while Gina is alive and walking around. It is a set of instructions embedded within her will.
Exactly. The trust literally only springs into legal existence after she dies.
This creates a critical timing issue that the exam loves to test. We know that a revocable living trust avoids probate court, right?
Yes.
So does a testamentary trust avoid probate?
Well, think about it.
If it's created by a will, and a will has to be validated by a probate judge, then no, it cannot avoid probate.
Correct. That is the trap. A testamentary trust must go through the probate process. The document that breathes life into the trust, the will, must be legally authenticated by the court.
And what does that mean for creditor protection? Like, if Gina dies and leaves $1 million to a testamentary trust designed for Frank, can Gina's outstanding creditors swoop in and grab that money before Frank gets it?
Yes, but timing is everything. During the probate process, the estate is wide open. It is vulnerable.
So they can attack it.
Gina's creditors can absolutely file claims against the estate and drain the funds to pay off her debts before the trust ever gets funded. A testamentary trust only offers irrevocable creditor protection after probate is completely closed, the judge bangs the gavel, all creditors have been paid off, and the surviving cash is officially transferred into the trust.
The timeline dictates the vulnerability. Now, speaking of the estate itself, the estate is also considered a legal entity by the exam.
Right. It's that temporary bucket that holds Gina's assets between the exact moment she dies and the moment the assets are finally distributed to the heirs or the trusts.
And an estate is managed by an executor if she had a valid will, or an administrator appointed by the court if she died without one. These individuals have strict fiduciary duties, just like a trustee.
They absolutely do.
I have another direct question for you, listener. Let's say you're a professional investment advisor. The executor of Gina's estate hires you to manage the millions of dollars in cash sitting in the estate while the probate process drags on for the next 18 months.
Okay.
What should your primary investment objective be? Should you take that cash and buy 10-year growth stocks, or perhaps a highly volatile tech ETF to try and maximize the return for the heirs? Think about the mechanics of the estate.
Think about the timeline here.
Absolutely not. You would probably lose your license for doing that.
You would definitely get sued. The investment objective for an estate is almost universally capital preservation and liquidity.
So short-term, ultra-safe stuff?
Short-term, ultra-safe instruments like treasury bills or money market funds. Why? Because an estate is a temporary transitional entity. It does not exist long enough to have a 10-year time horizon.
The executor needs cash on hand.
Exactly. They need cash to pay funeral expenses, pay final tax bills, pay lawyers. settle debts with creditors, and eventually distribute the exact remaining amount to the beneficiaries. You cannot have that money locked up in an illiquid partnership or exposed to a massive 20% stock market correction right when the tax bill is due.
The time horizon dictates the strategy. Short time horizon equals high liquidity and low risk.
Spot on.
Okay, let's fast forward. Gina's estate is settled, but before she passed, she made some major philanthropic decisions. She looked at Frank, realized his lemonade factory is making millions, and decided he actually has enough money.
Good for Frank.
Good for Frank. So she decided she wants to give the vast majority of her remaining fortune to charity. This brings us to charitable trusts, foundations, and donor-advised funds.
Let's start with charitable trusts, specifically what the IRS calls split interest trusts. The exam focuses on two main types: the Charitable Remainder Trust, or CRT, and the Charitable Lead Trust, or CLT.
I want you to visualize these two trusts as looking in a mirror. They're exact mathematical opposites of each other.
Okay, I like that.
A split interest trust takes a pile of money and splits it into two things, an ongoing income stream and a final lump sum left over at the end. It's all about who gets the income stream now and who gets the lump sum later.
Let's break down the mechanics of the Charitable Remainder Trust first, the CRT. In a CRT, the ongoing income stream goes to a named individual, say Gina herself while she's alive, or maybe Frank for a specific period of time.
Okay.
This period can be for the rest of their natural life or a fixed term up to a maximum of 20 years.
So Frank gets a nice steady check every single month for 20 years. It acts almost like an annuity. Mm-hmm. But what happens at the end of the 20 years when the term actually expires?
At the end of the term, whatever money is left over in the trust, the remainder goes to the designated charity.
Wait, I see a potential loophole here. Let's say I fund a CRT with $1 million. I mandate that the trust pays me $100,000 a year for 20 years. That's $2 million total.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
I take a massive upfront charitable tax deduction for setting up the trust, but I mathematically bleed the trust completely dry so the charity gets exactly zero at the end. Can I do that?
You used to be able to do that,
yeah.
Which is why the IRS stepped in and created a strict mechanical rule.
Ah, they caught on.
They did.
Yeah.
The IRS requires an actuarial calculation when you set up a CRT. The projected remainder going to the charity at the end of the term must mathematically equal at least 10% of the initial fair market value of the assets you put in.
So if you put in $1 million.
If you put in $1 million, the math must project that the charity gets at least $100,000 at the end. If the math doesn't work, the IRS rejects the trust and you lose your tax deduction completely.
They close the loophole. Okay, now let's look in the mirror at the exact opposite structure, the Charitable Lead Trust, or CLT.
In a CLT, the roles completely flip. The charity gets the income stream first, they take the lead.
So the charity gets a steady check every month for 20 years.
Yes. And at the end of the term, when the trust terminates, the remainder lump sum passes down to Gina's non-charitable heirs. Like Frank.
Here is my ultimate exam tip for these trusts. Do not overcomplicate the mechanics when you're staring at a multiple choice question. Just look at the name of the trust.
It's all in the name.
The name literally tells you who gets the money at the end or who gets it first. Charitable Remainder Trust, the charity gets the remainder. Charitable Lead Trust, the charity gets the lead, the front end income stream. The answer is hidden right there in the acronym.
That's a fantastic mnemonic to rely on. Now, what if Gina doesn't want to bother with a 20-year split interest trust? What if she wants to create a massive, enduring, philanthropic legacy like the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation?
He goes bigger.
She can set up a private foundation.
Yeah. A private foundation is usually funded by a single concentrated source, right? Like one wealthy individual, one family, or one corporation.
Yes.
Generous Gina takes $50 million and legally creates the Gina Foundation. It is recognized by the IRS as a tax-exempt charitable organization.
But because it is funded by one source and entirely controlled by a private board of directors, which usually just consists of Gina, her lawyer, and her best friends, the IRS puts it under intense regulatory scrutiny.
They don't trust them.
They don't. They have incredibly strict limits on self-dealing. Gina cannot use foundation money to buy herself a luxury yacht and classify it as a marine biology research vessel.
I mean, people have tried.
They've tried, and the penalties for that are astronomical.
And this brings us to a massive, heavily tested concept, the 5% rule.
Oh, this is essential.
To understand why this rule exists, you have to look at history. In the past, wealthy families would put their fortunes into private foundations to avoid estate taxes. The foundation would invest the money, grow massively, and pay huge salaries to the family members sitting on the board.
Sounds great for the family.
Right. But they would never actually give any money to real charities. They just hoarded the wealth tax-free.
To combat that hoarding, Congress instituted a forced mechanic. A private foundation must distribute at least 5% of its net investment assets annually in the form of qualifying charitable grants.
They are legally forced to give that 5% away every single year, regardless of whether the stock market is up or down.
Doesn't matter if it's down, 5% goes out.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, private foundations are subjected to an excise tax on their net investment income. Currently, it's a 1.39% tax.
I've always found that confusing. I thought charities were, by definition, tax exempt.
Well, they are exempt from income tax on the donations they receive. But private foundations specifically are penalized with this 1.39% excise tax on the investment income their endowment generates in the stock market.
Okay, that makes sense. And to add another layer of friction, when Gina donates cash to her own private foundation, her personal tax deduction is capped at a lower limit, isn't it?
Usually 30% of her adjusted gross income.
So let's summarize the pain points of a private foundation. A mandatory 5% forced distribution, an annoying 1.39% excise tax on investment growth, and a heavily restricted tax deduction limit for the donor.
It's a lot of hurdles.
Why is the IRS so inherently hostile to private foundations compared to regular public charities?
It fundamentally comes down to control and public accountability. A public charity, like the Red Cross or your local animal shelter, gets its funding from a broad cross-section of the general public.
Right.
If a public charity misbehaves or wastes money, the public finds out, they stop donating, and the charity goes bankrupt. There's a natural free market mechanism of accountability.
But a private foundation?
A private foundation sits on a mountain of a single family's money. It's completely immune to public opinion. It doesn't need to fundraise. So the IRS uses these strict rules and taxes as an artificial mechanism to force them to actually act charitably.
The IRS acts as the public watchdog. That makes perfect sense. So let's contrast that with a true public charity. There is no minimum 5% distribution requirement. There is no 1.39% excise tax on their investment income.
And if you donate cash to a public charity, you get a much more favorable tax deduction limit, up to 50% of your adjusted gross income.
So if you see an exam question that asks, which client type is subject to a mandatory annual distribution requirement?
The answer is strictly a private foundation, not a public charity, and definitely not our final topic of the day, the Donor Advised Fund.
Ah, the Donor Advised Fund, or DAF? These have absolutely exploded in popularity over the last decade.
They really have.
Yeah.
Let's say Gina looks at the legal paperwork, the expense of lawyers, the 5% mandatory distribution, and the excise tax of setting up a private foundation. She gets a headache.
It's too much work.
She says, this is way too much administrative work. I just want a cheap, simple way to give $10 million away right now, get my massive tax deduction this year, but decide where the money actually goes later.
Enter the DAF. A donor-advised fund is essentially a charitable giving account. It is administered by a sponsoring organization, which is legally classified as a public charity.
Right. So Gina writes a check for $10 million and hands it over to the DAF sponsor. Because she gave the money to a recognized public charity sponsor, she gets that massive immediate tax deduction on her tax return for the current year.
She gets the full 60% AGI limit.
She gets the big deduction instantly.
But here is the absolute magic of the DAF mechanic. She does not have to decide which end-use charities get the money today.
Right. She can just wait.
The money can sit in the DAF account, fully invested in the stock market, growing completely tax-free for years or even decades. There is no 5% forced distribution rule for a DAF.
Which brings us to our final trap. The question of legal control. I have a direct question for you, listener.
Pay attention.
Gina put $10 million into the DAF in 2020. 5 years later, Frank starts a highly questionable, borderline fraudulent charity called the Frantic Frank Lemonade for Dogs Foundation.
Sounds terrible.
Oh, it's a scam. Gina decides she wants to give Frank $1 million from the DAF to support his ridiculous venture. Can Gina legally force the donor-advised fund sponsor to write that check to Frank's charity?
Think about the mechanics of a completed gift, listener. Give it a second.
The answer is absolutely not.
Not a chance.
The DAF donor can only recommend grants. They cannot control, they cannot mandate, and they cannot legally compel the sponsoring organization to do anything.
Because when Gina handed over the $10 million in 2020, she made an irrevocable completed gift.
Exactly. She surrendered all legal ownership and control of those funds. Mm-hmm. The sponsoring organization has the final, ultimate say over where the money goes.
Now, in reality, the sponsor will almost always honor her recommendation as long as she is pointing the money toward a legitimate, registered 501c3 charity, right? That's their business model.
Yeah, they want to keep donors happy.
Well, if she tries to do something sketchy, like self-dealing to Frank's bizarre unregistered dog lemonade charity, the sponsor will simply say no. And Gina has zero legal recourse.
The secret is right in the name. It's a donor-advised fund. It's right. Not a donor-controlled fund.
Donor-advised, exactly. And that total surrender of legal control is just the price she pays for the administrative simplicity and the maximized tax deduction.
It's the trade-off.
Take a deep breath. We just covered a massive, sprawling amount of legal, historical, and structural ground.
We covered a ton.
We went from a guy selling lemons on the street corner with infinite liability to highly engineered, charitable giving vehicles used by billionaires. It is time to lock this into your short-term memory before you sit for the exam.
It's rapid fire time.
We are doing the rapid fire recap. I'm going to throw out a concept, and the expert is going to deliver the testable one-liner answer. Ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
Sole proprietorship liability.
Unlimited personal liability. The owner is the business. There's no legal separation.
Entity with a strict 100 shareholder limit.
The S corporation.
Yeah.
And they must all be domestic individual.
Entity plagued by double taxation.
The C corporation. The corporate entity is taxed on profits, and the shareholders are taxed again on dividends.
What structure gives you both pass-through taxation and limited liability protection?
The LLC or the S corporation.
Does a revocable living trust remove assets from the taxable estate?
No. It avoids probate court. But because the grantor retains control, only an irrevocable trust successfully removes assets from the taxable estate.
Mandatory 5% annual distribution rule.
Private foundation only.
Incredible. If you can memorize that rapid fire list and understand the mechanics we discussed today, you are going to absolutely crush this section of the test.
You really will.
But before we let you get back to your day, the expert has a final provocative thought for you to chew on as you continue your studies.
Yeah, so today we spent our entire time talking about classifying the types or the legal structures of clients. Are they an individual, a corporation, a partnership, or a trust?
Right.
But as you move through your study material, I want you to keep your eyes peeled for a completely different classification system, the wealth thresholds of clients.
Okay, wealth threshold.
I'm talking about terms you will see later, like accredited investors under Regulation D, qualified clients for performance-based fees, and qualified purchasers for private hedge funds.
We didn't touch those today.
We didn't, because they live in entirely different regulatory chapters. But understanding the difference between the structure of a client, which is how they're legally billed, and the wealth classification of a client, which dictates what highly risky investments they are legally allowed to buy, is the final key to truly unlocking the regulatory sections of this exam.
That's a huge distinction.
Structure is the vehicle. Right. Wealth is the license to drive fast. Keep those two concepts distinct in your mind, and the exam will open up for you.
Structure is the vehicle. Wealth is the license. That is a brilliant distinction to end on. Well, that is it for this deep dive. Congratulations on upgrading your exam prep brain today.
You're one step closer.
You are a solid 3% closer to passing this thing and moving on with your career. Keep reviewing those flashcards. Keep digging into the mechanical why behind the material. And remember that every complex financial rule you learn is ultimately just a story about someone trying to protect their money or the IRS trying to tax it. Go crush your studying, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.